Welcome again to the Outrig Capercast. This is number 5. And since number 4, Christy has really been beating me up. Here's an example of what I've been getting from her.
Jimmy Brownie? That's a dirty trick. Arthur Piver was never seen again? That just cannot be the end of it. What about his family? His boat? And you also left us hanging from your so-called whopping great adventures in Baja, with your boat gone and your wife pregnant in a hurricane. Oh sure, it's all written up in your memoir. Sounds to me like snake oil for selling books. You'll turn everybody off that way.
Oh, heck, I was just trying to get on with it, but you're right, there were real repercussions from the disappearance of Arthur Piver. He utterly disappeared. No evidence of anything was ever found, either out at sea or on any of the California beaches. And of course, the rumors abounded. Piver always joked about how if you had one of his trimarans, the world is your oyster, boy, and alluding to bikini-clad beaches and a life of freedom and adventure. And for years, there were reports of sightings in this Shangri-La or that ballyhoo. And of course, his wife and daughters were devastated. Furthermore, because of absolute lack of evidence, they were prevented from accessing his life insurance for years. And furthermore, his being just plain lost at sea dropped a bomb on the yachting community. Because of his penchant for promotional bombast, he was viewed by the Corinthian community as somewhat of a huckster. And the trouble was that you had to know him intimately in order to understand that he really believed what he was saying about multi-hulls. He tended to speak in terms of not only what multi-hulls were, but what he knew they would become. He was a visionary. He knew what was coming. And there were those who believed him and those who didn't. And those who didn't had not yet been to sea in one of his boats or a good one like it. Now, I say a good one because there were a lot of bad ones. Remember that these boats were all produced by amateur builders in backyards. And there was a great deal of variation in the results. Part of the problem was that Piver's early plans were very rudimentary, and this tended to encourage improvisation by the builders. And because so many of the builders knew absolutely nothing of seafaring, they tended to really pile on the top hamper. So many of the boats were hideously modified in the interest of increasing their interior commodiousness, with absolutely no regard for the effect on seakeeping properties. And furthermore, as a result of pressure from his clientele for more space inside the boats, he eliminated the centerboard or daggerboard, which was really an intrusion on the accommodation. And I admit that centerboards and daggerboards are a real pain in the neck, but you get something for them. You get the so-called lateral resistance that prevents the boats from sliding sideways from wind pressure in the sails. So without the centerboard or daggerboard, and with the added top hamper and the tendency to overbuild, overweight, overload, the boats developed a well-earned reputation for being unable to go to windward, to tack and maneuver dependably, and to exhibit firm control when steering downwind in big waves. To me, it seemed absolutely diabolical that so many trimarans of the early 1960s did not exhibit the basic, splendid sailing properties of Piver's original Frolic and Nugget trimarans. And looking back on it now, I can see that these teething problems were to be expected in such an upstart, countercultural, sociological phenomenon as the early modern multi-hull. You know how they say in business that timing is everything. Well, I think it was certainly true in the 1960s of vessels that were built by owners for serious seafaring. They were not all lightweight. There was a very strong movement in the ferro-cement construction at that time. And like all boat-building methods, ferro-cement could be pretty good and not all that heavy if it was done right. Like all boat-building methods, it has to be done right. But they were not lightweight, and they were difficult, more difficult for owner-builders than one would imagine. In fact, so few of them were completed that the naval architect Bill Garden from the Northwest, he said that the one cost factor that ferro-cement builders did not include in their original costing calculations was the demolition costs. You had to hire a swinging ball in order to smash the things up and put them away. And also in this period, we saw a bunch of very fanciful stuff coming out of the backyards. People would get an idea about boat design and run with it, whether or not the world liked the idea or not. And I mean, there were boats that looked like flying saucers, Swiss chalets, Sherman tanks. The inventiveness was wonderful, but they weren't what you'd call seafaring vessels. But leading the way in this subcultural burst of activity were the catamaran designs by James Wareham and the trimaran designs by Arthur Piver. They were certainly not alone, but they were leading the way in popularity. Now, I've often wondered what explains this phenomenon. It couldn't have been just that all of a sudden sailing became very popular. No, the multi-hull had to happen as a result of the foment of the times. The 1960s was a pretty desperate time in the United States. The Cold War was really threatening with the possibility of nuclear annihilation. And after the economic boom of the 1950s, the economy was starting to tighten up. And by the late 60s, it was quite clear that we were losing the Vietnam War, and we were very guilty about it. A lot of folks were plain fed up with having their tax dollars spent on really hurting so many other people. And at times, it looked like the moral revolution of the counterculture really had the potential to dismount the federal government. So what we saw in our own clientele was fear, paranoia, and escapism. A lot of folks felt that if they were to consolidate their assets in a vehicle that would also be a home and in which they could carry along large portions of their own culture and that would allow them mobility, the ability to move to avoid geopolitical hotspots, and if worse came to worse, give them the chance to somehow make a living with or from their boat, even if it involved eating a lot of fish. So I think the escape motive had a lot to do with the popularity of the early cruising multi-hulls. And incidentally, I think it still has a lot to do, subliminally at least, with most yacht ownership. People can't help but think of their boats as the last ditch stand. And things today have changed so much, but that escapism motive may be coming around again on the guitar. You know, with the world economy in such fragile condition, terrorism, disease, water problems. But escape from is certainly accompanied by escape to. People are still looking for adventure. And ocean cruising is a pretty good place to find it. Now, back in the 70s, we always thought that there certainly must be some unspecified sanctuary someplace that we could find in our boats and go settle down, make a stand. The quest that we used to call seasteading. It's not as easy to do these days as it was back then because the world has become so much more crowded. We think of the population bomb as going off in the developing world, but the truth is that the population of the United States has tripled in my lifetime. And if we were faced with something like agricultural collapse or economic collapse or governmental dysfunction, who knows whether having a cruising sailboat would be a good way out. Nowadays, the question is, where would you go? Well, there are answers to that question, and let's hope that we can talk about them here on Jim Brown's Outrigged Capercast. And when we do, I think it'll help for us to bear in mind where all of this modern seafaring stuff came from. And Arthur Piver, with his ebullience, his enthusiasm, his vision of the multi-hull future, certainly had a lot to do with getting it started. Now, I was just his first blue water guinea pig, so to speak, totally voluntary now. But Christy feels I'd better fill you in on how that voyage down to Baja really ended. In caper number 4, I mentioned that we had sailed south out of the wind and into the heat in late summer 1959, and as we drifted along the shore, the desert shore, one day, all of a sudden we noticed up ahead there was an oasis, waving palm trees and fields of sugar cane. And we thought, oh my God, there's got to be people in there and something cold to drink. There was a rocky promontory sticking out, the chart called Punta Lobos, Wolf Point, and a crescent beach to the north of it. No protection, no harbor. But as we came close, we noticed a few large rowboat-like vessels pulled up on the beach and a couple of guys around. So we anchored in pretty deep water. We had to join our two anchor ropes together in order to get enough scope. And we waved and they hollered, and pretty soon one of these guys came out over the surf, open ocean surf, rowing a great big boat, pulled alongside and took us ashore. Pretty soon a man showed up who spoke some English, and he had a jeep, and he offered to take us into town. It was a couple miles. And it was clear that this town was an ancient sugar port, but it had certainly fallen on hard times. And the people there were so unaccustomed to visitors that we became quite the attraction. Turns out that the place is now quite a thriving resort. But I'm certain that one reason that the three of us sort of drew a crowd was that Joanna was the star of the show. They were just shocked to see a pregnant woman who had come by sea. The folks were very friendly. I had a little Spanish at that time. Food and drink began to appear. The men attempted to convince Joanna that their dark beer would be very good for mother's milk. And when the sun went down, folks started showing up in their finery and some potluck and more dark beer. We were really enjoying ourselves to the point where it was clear we were not going back to the boat that night. So we were shown to the Hotel California, which was a crumbling adobe structure since restored into a wonderful place. But we crashed on bare mattresses in a room somewhere. And in the morning, the family that was sort of the custodians of the place very kindly fixed us a nice breakfast. And while we were eating, the man who had brought us in his jeep the day before walked into the kitchen and said, "Oh, I thought you were gone. Your boat is gone." Well, still today, 50-some years later, just telling of it just sends knots in my stomach. The guy took us dashing back down to the beach. We went running out on the sand, and sure as hell the anchorage was empty. The boat was not sitting on the beach, was not stacked up on the rocks of the promontory. It had simply vanished. Well, up on the top of this promontory, this big pile of slag that was sticking out to sea, we saw several people. And the man with the jeep said he would go get binoculars. Well, we climbed up on this big pile of rocks and looked out to sea. About a mile out, there was a haze line. We couldn't see very far. But there was a man there whom we came to call Strong Eyes. and he kept pointing out to sea and trying to tell me he could see the boat. Well, when the binoculars arrived, I asked to borrow them, and I got down behind this guy's shoulders. Strong Eyes pointed out to sea. I looked out over his blurry fingertip exactly where he was pointed. I couldn't see the boat, not even with binoculars, and neither could our buddy Dick. But Strong Eyes insisted. He said he could borrow an outboard motor and take his skiff and take us out there to go get the boat. Well, we didn't know what to believe. We thought someone might have taken it. The guy with the Jeep insisted, hey, you could leave your wallet on a stick in the middle of Main Street and nobody would touch it. They might not tell you where it was, but nobody would touch it. So Dick and I decided to split up. He went with Strong Eyes in the boat, and I hiked down the coast. It was rugged from there, one craggy cove after another, and it was all day, a real ordeal. I was unprepared, no water, was in sandals and shorts, and oh man, I was frantic to find out what had happened to my boat. But sometime in early afternoon, I decided to start back, and as I approached the original promontory, I was able to get to a vantage where I could look down and see Joanna sitting in the sand. They had taken her during the day. They had taken her to a shady shelter and been very good to her, but she wanted to be back down on the beach when the sun got low. And I went down to her, and we had a talk. You know, it was clear that our plans had changed. She reminded me that our thin pack of traveler's checks was on the boat. But she said that the people who had cared for her that day insisted that she could have the baby there. Why don't we just come and live in Todos Santos? You know. Well, we sat sort of spooned together on the sand there for a while, and tried to take solace when we heard a shout from up on the promontory. The people were still up there. There had been people up on that pile of rocks all day. And from what I could hear, they seemed to be shouting something like the birds. And a binocular man appeared coming across the sand and explained. He said, "They say your boat looks like a bird. They are bringing your bird." Well, I just flipped out with relief. The only thing I could do was to strip off my sandals and dive into the ocean. And I swam for that point. Boy, I got, I don't know, a ways out there. And around the corner came Strong Eyes, standing in the stern of his boat with his hat over his heart. He was the epitome of triumph. The people on the promontory were cheering. And then around the corner came Juana, with Dick at the helm, sailing in a light breeze. He sailed for me, sailed right over me. I was able to grab the net and the crossbeams and swing up onto my boat. And, oh, man, I was just overwhelmed with relief and gratitude. Dick said there was no way he could have seen that boat. He just knew where it was. And what had happened, of course, is that where I had joined the two anchor lines together, they had come apart. I had tied a small grappling hook into that knot to use it as a farthing weight to sort of take the snub of the surge of the sea off of the anchor, and the farthing weight had somehow managed to untie the knot, so I was able to dive up our real anchor. Actually, we just joined the lines again. Strong Eyes went to retrieve Joanna, bring her aboard, and all the other fishing boats came. Our boat was just crowded with people for a little while, and they offered to take us back in, spend another night ashore, but I was unwilling to leave the boat in such a location again. I had learned my lesson, boy. So we gave Strong Eyes what I now consider to be a woefully inadequate payment for his wonderful services. And as the sun went down, we upped the anchor and continued south. And well, Christy's trying to be nice, but she's twisting my ear. We're going to have to take it up again, perhaps in caper number 6. Hope to see you there. Bye-bye.